Dudes and dudettes, welcome back to The Anxious Truth. This is episode number 136. Welcome back to the show. Today we have a special guest, my new friend Jenna Overbaugh. Jenna is a licensed professional therapist and counselor. She specializes in treating anxiety, OCD, and other anxiety disorders, and she also happens to be a certified personal trainer. So she's also in the fitness game, which is great. Because today we're going to talk about the link between fitness, diet, exercise, and anxiety disorders. And we're going to have a discussion about something called orthorexia. Orthorexia is a disorder that's kind of an eating disorder, definitely part of the anxiety disorder complex, where people become convinced that they must eat specific foods to be okay, to achieve their fitness goals, or to be okay, to achieve their health goals. Orthorexia is a real thing. And it actually is a little bit more prevalent in the anxiety community than we would think. So Jenna and I are going to talk about that because it is something that she deals with on a regular basis on an inpatient in a residential facility. So that's going to be super interesting. Before we bring Jenna on and get cooking, you know what I'm going to do. In fact, this past week that I'm recording, the audiobook version of my book is out. So I'm super happy that I don't have to answer the question, when's the audiobook version coming out? It's out. Anyway, I'm going to tell you about my book. It is called The Anxious Truth, A Step-by-Step Guide to Understanding and Overcoming Panic, Anxiety, and Agoraphobia. It's 70,000 words. It's 400 printed pages. It's essentially everything you've ever heard me say on social media or on a podcast about recovering from an anxiety disorder, just laid out in a specific sequence and in much greater detail. So it's like taking a course on how to solve the problem and overcome the issue. So if you have not checked it out, you can find it at theanxioustruth.com/recovery guide. If you have checked it out, you've read it, you like it, you're using it, it's helping you, maybe go over to Amazon and write a review. I would appreciate it. Anyway, okay, so let's get cooking. Jenna Overbaugh is here. We're going to talk about fitness and anxiety. We're going to talk about exercise and anxiety, diet and anxiety. We're going to talk about orthorexia, which is a super interesting topic. So let's get rolling. All righty, here we are. Jenna Overbaugh, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really passionate about this topic, and I think we're going to talk about some really great stuff.
Yeah, I think so too. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. Like, you and I just kind of accidentally bumped into each other online, it appears.
I love podcasts. I'm a podcast junkie, and we'll get into it later, but I have one of my own. And as I often do, just kind of browsing new anxiety podcasts, I came across yours and I've been loving it. So I'm transitioning right now into private practice and just trying to consume as much kind of resources as I can, and podcasts are a great way to do that. And you've been super helpful. It's been an amazing time listening to you.
Well, let's talk about your podcast for a second, because the thing that I will admit, I have not heard any of it yet because I just kind of stumbled upon you, but it's called All the Hard Things. I mean, come on.
Yes.
It's a great name for a podcast.
Hard Things. And we talk about all the hard things.
So really, like, you just stuck out. When I looked, I'm like, oh, well, this is here. I need to be friends with Jenna here, because clearly you and I speak very similar language when it comes to dealing with anxiety disorders, which is awesome. And you have been involved in residential treatment facilities, right? So let's give people an idea where you're coming from. Like, what's your background on this?
Yeah. So I feel like I've always been a little bit of an anxious person, a little bit of an anxious kid. And then when I went into college, my Psych 101 course, I learned about exposure and response prevention as a potential treatment for disorders. And I loved it. I fell in love with the idea of it. I thought it was so super cool. And that led me into my passion to work with the anxiety and OCD population. So right away, right at the beginning of my college undergrad experience, I started to work with that population. I went into grad school at Towson University in Baltimore, where I specialized in the treatment and research of people who have OCD and anxiety. And yeah, upon graduation, immediately I got into what I have always wanted to do, which is residential treatment for OCD and anxiety. Yeah. So currently I work at a residential OCD and treatment facility, meaning we have residents, we call them residents, they're clients who basically they drop everything and they come to live with us in this big mansion.
Wow.
For 45 to 60 days is our average length of stay.
Yeah.
And they stay here. I mean, pre-COVID, we were able to take them out on public outings and whatnot. So it was not a lockdown facility by any means.
Yeah.
But they are so debilitated by their OCD and anxiety that they're not able to care for themselves independently.
Yep.
Or really function at a lower level of care. So So yeah, there are two, maybe three residential OCD and anxiety units in the country. Mm-hmm. And so I feel really lucky to be one of those providers. It's really awesome.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I did not even know those two facilities existed, which is impressive. Mm-hmm. It's good to know they're there, and I'm glad that you were in there. Yeah. So you are also, you are a personal trainer also.
Yes. So somewhere along the way, and I think it's because as our cases here have gotten so complex and, you know, they're presenting as having a lot of comorbid conditions, a lot of them are presenting with some eating disordered concerns. And sometimes that takes the case, you know, takes the form of anorexia or bulimia or ED not otherwise specified. But what we're seeing a lot of is orthorexia, which is this really rigid way of eating, where it's focused primarily on the quality of the food that you intake and not like anorexia or bulimia, where it's about the quantity.
Right.
Orthorexia is about this rigidity as far as the ingredients that you're consuming and the, you know, just the quality of the food. And so as I started to get more and more interested in that, I thought becoming a personal trainer would be a really great complement to that. And I've always been passionate about fitness. It's a way for me to combine my two loves.
Well, I think it's good because it gives you a good perspective on this. And it really, like, you had reached out and was like, hey, we should collaborate. And as soon as I saw that you posted about orthorexia, I'm like, let's do it right now. Because I have not seen anybody talk about orthorexia. And I will tell you that as somebody who spent time in competitive powerlifting and being a gym rat, and you know, I kind of dig my weights, I have seen quite a few young men, especially, I mean, and that's anecdotal, that's not scientific in any way, who clearly are in the grips of orthorexia. Now, their orthorexia is centered on, like, you know, got to preserve the gains, they're trying to get ripped, whatever it is, you know, if I eat anything more than chicken breasts, sweet potatoes, and broccoli, I will explode. But I think I'd like to talk about orthorexia as you have seen it in relation to some of these anxiety disorders, because I have seen quite a few listeners who get locked into, there's a phobia component for many people. They become afraid of certain foods because they think those foods trigger panic. But more so, they are incredibly concerned about eating the cleanest, healthiest, most nutrient-dense foods because they are convinced that is keeping them safe from their anxiety. Mm-hmm. It is helping their anxiety. They're still struggled. They're still struggling and trapped, but they have somehow decided that eating the right things is part of how they will solve the problem. Is this something that you see?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So as if anxiety didn't already suck enough, you can actually be anxious about becoming anxious, which is a thing.
Yeah.
And there's a whole treatment for that. And so, especially if somebody is being really rigid about their food intake because they feel or believe that they cannot possibly tolerate the anxiety or the panic that comes as a consequence if they steer away from that a little bit, that would definitely be problematic. And so the word here that comes to mind for me is like rigid versus flexible. So the individuals who really struggle with this, they may start out with really good intentions. It's focused on weight. And of course, they're influenced by our toxic diet and fitness culture, which emphasizes no carbs and these fad diets like Whole30. And so it starts out really well intentioned, like, oh, I'm being healthy. Like, it's good to not eat sugar. I hear about this all the time. But it becomes pathological when we become so rigid about it and it guides our decisions versus us guiding our decisions.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always think about it as far as like who's driving the car, like who's driving the decisions here? Is it the anxiety about the quality of the food, or are you able to be more flexible as far as like work potlucks? You know, you can have a preference for health foods versus what you deem as not healthy foods. But when you feel like there's anxiety associated with your decisions and you're being really rigid about your decisions, that's when it can become pathological for sure.
Or we see those typical distortions that come with most anxiety disorders. And often those, the people that understand those distortions most of all, well, a rapid heartbeat means I'm having a heart attack. Clearly a distortion based on catastrophic thinking, and that's common. But also, oh, if I eat some sugar, something terrible will happen. I may experience anxiety, but sugar is poison. It's like heroin. I read all the articles. Instagram tells me this. And I think, and I don't know if this is your experience, but yes, I love how you said the toxic diet, eating, and fitness community online. Oh, yeah. And it absolutely is. I mean, it's insanity when you think about it.
Yeah.
That's not helping.
I think that contributes the toxicity of our diet and fitness culture.
Yeah.
Emphasizing health primarily as being related to thinness or, you know, based on aesthetic qualities versus more internal qualities of health. It perpetuates this idea that if you obsess about your food and you cut out these whole entire food groups and you control everything, it's okay because it's healthy. And I think it's no different than any other behavior. Anything can become pathological when it's viewed with fear and control and rigidity.
Yeah, this is true. Just as an aside, you should follow Pixie Nutrition. Do you follow Pixie Nutrition on Instagram?
I don't, but I will.
You will love her because she is no nonsense. She's a registered nutritionist and dietitian. I think she's from the UK, I believe, but she is continually throwing a sledgehammer through all of that silly nonsense.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I think we're getting a little bit better with intuitive eating and all that stuff, but that's kind of the direction I'd like for these individuals to go and for our fitness culture and a diet culture to go. But our diet culture and fitness culture thrive on our insecurity. They do not thrive on promoting intuitive eating.
And what's tough about that is somebody in the grips of an anxiety disorder is not making good decisions. They're not coming from a place of security and confidence. They're coming from fear and vulnerability. So while those people might not be meaning to prey on that, they are accidentally preying on people who are in a very vulnerable and suggestible state. So if I only eat these particular foods, I might actually start to feel better. Okay, I'll listen to this person. Or the fallacy of what sounds like common sense. We anthropomorphize biochemical processes to make them sort of sound right to us, and people fall prey to that all the time. How do you deal with that? When you're dealing with somebody who has fallen into sort of an orthorexic state, you can't just tell them, be more flexible, because we know that doesn't work. So how do you actually approach that? Somebody who feels like their diet is controlling them now. Mm-hmm. What are the steps?
I think the first step is education, because like you and I are talking about, I think so many people allow this, consciously or not, to fly under the radar because it's under this umbrella of, it's healthy. I'm doing this for my health. So what's the big deal? It's not like OCD or, you know, contamination, where obviously we know that obsessively washing your hands to where they're raw and bloody, we know that that's unhealthy. We know that that's a problem.
Yeah.
We know that giving into social anxiety to the extent where you can't function in school or work, that's a problem. But because these patterns exist under the umbrella of healthy eating and all of that, because of our toxic diet and fitness culture, we kind of let it fly under the radar. So to get back to your question, I think the first step is education, which is why I wanted to do this podcast in the first place, just putting it out there that anything can turn into pathological behavior. So it's one thing to be motivated by health. It's another thing to be motivated by, I have to eat this way, otherwise I'm going to be anxious and I can't tolerate that.
Right.
So just educate, like eye-opening that way, I think is super important. And then the frustrating thing about orthorexia is it's not officially recognized as a disorder.
Right.
So, and there are a lot of reasons why that is, probably because fitness culture and all that, it's allowed us or has kind of encouraged just us brushing it under the rug. So it's not officially recognized as a disorder. I think it will be with more research and, you know, as more people talk about it. So it is responsive to treatment. So what we would do for somebody in treatment is to work with, we would apply just a regular CBT method to them. So cognitive behavioral therapy. We would work on their behaviors. Mm-hmm. So once they're on board, once they're willing, we would, you know, obviously educate them about CBT and exposure and response prevention. And we would do exposures with these people. So we would, it might be an exposure for somebody to, you know, take a bite of food and not look at the ingredients. I've had so many people, they only shop at Whole Foods and they only eat all organic. And it's like, okay, well, maybe we try a different, maybe you can still eat all organic at first, right? Because with the hierarchy and working on exposures, we do everything gradually. So maybe we don't go just to Whole Foods and only have all organic. Maybe we try all organic at Trader Joe's.
Right.
Maybe so just breaking them out of that rigidity a little bit, mm-hmm. trying to get them to work outside the box and do a little bit of what's uncomfortable. But then, I worked with a woman who she only would eat Whole Foods, all organic Whole Foods And by the end of treatment, we got her to eat a pizza and it was great. It wasn't organic. It was Pizza Hut. Yeah. It was awesome. And the idea is maybe she doesn't eat that way forever, right? Like she can have a preference to have healthy foods. She can have a preference to, for the most part, like do what works for her, but it wasn't working for her. And so it was all about trying to get this person to be more flexible, like potlucks. You know, baby showers, weddings. This person wasn't able to go to weddings because of the whole food issue. Like she was afraid of being even around other food.
Yeah.
That can also happen.
Yeah, it gets pretty extreme. And I think for people who are listening, who maybe are in that trap a little bit right now, that sounds, it's probably making them anxious just to hear that. And the point isn't that like, hey, Jenna got a woman to eat a pizza. Isn't that amazing? The pizza isn't the point. It's the liberation from the rigidity and the catastrophic results that you think will result from that pizza, being freed from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and that might be a thing that that woman chooses to not necessarily eat, which would be a good choice. You don't want to eat a lot of Pizza Hut pizza. There's nothing wrong with that. But not to be afraid to eat it. There's no dire consequences from a slice of pizza.
Yeah, absolutely. So there were two models taking place there. And we, as more comes out, there's obviously the habituation model. So, this woman started out, you know, being anxiety, it was anxiety provoking at first. Yeah. She eventually got to the point where that was no longer anxiety provoking for her. She habituated to it. That's what we would call it in the field, obviously. Yeah. But then there's also the inhibitory learning model, which gave her, as she did these successive trials of eating challenging things, she learned, you know, I can break away from this 100% all the time control. I have to control everything.
Yeah.
And maybe she gets anxious, maybe she doesn't, but she's able to tolerate the outcome.
Yeah.
And that's the big point.
And in the end, the outcome is positive or not catastrophic. So it's the continued repeated outcome of positive exposure without the prevention, exposure and response prevention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's Friday. I got to talk about inhibitory learning models. Like it's a good Friday. I can't think of a better day. So,
Well, and we would call that, and you're probably familiar with it too. You're so knowledgeable, but for your listeners, we call it a corrective experience. Mm-hmm. Like this idea, you kind of like ride the wave of anxiety. You come down the hill from that anxiety experience and you're like, oh my gosh, one, I did it. Like I'm awesome.
Yeah.
Which is just the coolest thing to experience as a therapist. And then two, which is, I thought that I was going to have a panic attack and I didn't.
Right.
I thought that I was going to, you know, gain 20 pounds and I didn't.
Right.
I thought that my workout the next day was going to be awful because I had that bite of pizza and I still kicked butt. Like those are all awesome corrective experiences for people to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Those repeated experiences with a positive outcome. That's what changes things. The key word being experience. And look, you guys, if you're listening, you've heard me say this again and again and again. It's the experience that teaches the lesson. It's never the thinking. You can't think your way to learning that lesson. Unfortunately, it would be so much better for us if we could, but we can't.
I know.
You have to do hard things. And that's where, like, I love the title of your podcast. I'm sure it was not easy for that woman to have that slice of pizza. It was a hard thing for her to do, but she learned from it. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you're bringing up something that's just so inherent in our cognitive behavioral therapy process, which is we really have to target the behaviors first.
Yeah.
So it's not that the thinking and the, you know, the irrational thought processes and what you're talking about, like the catastrophic thinking and the probability overestimation, we get to all of those things. But when we're talking about anxiety and particular orthorexia, we challenge the behaviors first. Those are the biggest priorities to change.
Yeah. The thoughts will be fueled by the behaviors in the end. So you have to. That's just the only way to do it. Let's shift gears for just a second. Before we went live, we were talking about another topic. This is going to be, let me preface this by saying, you guys know, if you've listened to me for any amount of time, like I'm a huge fan of exercise. It's what I do. Like I do my cardio, I lift, I'm a fan, like, and everybody should exercise. We should all move our bodies. But we were talking a little bit off the air about when it becomes a, there are people who self-medicate their anxiety disorders with alcohol or food or, you know, illegally obtained medications. There's a lot of forms of self-medication. And I have almost found that for some segment of the population, exercise and fitness and identifying with it is almost a form of self-soothing and self-medicating. So in other words, I am gripped by raging OCD or raging panic disorder, or I'm highly agoraphobic, but I'm working out every day. I'm shooting my Instagram selfies. I'm showing the world that I'm working out and I'm fit and I'm clean eating and I'm doing this latest 30-day challenge or whatever it happens to be. And it becomes a soothing mechanism as opposed to a means to just be healthy. And sometimes it becomes a proxy for progress on the anxiety front. Is this a thing that you have encountered Or am I just making that up?
Absolutely. So you're bringing up two things here. One, which is this idea that, again, this is just, I think, a different manifestation of what's at the core of the orthorexia.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What's at the core of orthorexia is this intention to be healthy, mm-hmm. but we're restricting our idea of what's healthy to be based on, in your example with the exercise, like aesthetic goals, or even if it's just performance goals, or right. what our experience is or our progress is in the gym.
Yeah.
We're not opening our minds to consider, well, healthy is also a matter of, are you able to go to work consistently? Are you managing your emotional and social relationships? Right. Are you meeting other goals, or even do you have other goals in your life? And so we have to, I think, first and foremost, expand our idea of what healthy is. To be above and beyond what we're consuming as far as food goes and, ingredients go, and expand it beyond what it just means, like what we're doing in the gym.
Yeah.
Health is just so much more multifaceted than that, including things like our mental health, right? So you might be chasing pathologically this physical fitness in the gym, but your mental health may be deteriorating because you're isolating yourself and, contributing to depression or anxiety or whatever. And then, I think that over-exercising is just another manifestation of the orthorexia, because again, it's intention is to maintain health, but it's so rigid. And these are the individuals who, they don't prefer to work out. They need to work out.
Right, exactly.
And they're not able to handle life when an injury happens or COVID happens and the gym's closed down.
Right.
And then they're kind of left, as opposed to having this natural reaction of like, oh, that sucks, man. Like, I really wanted to go to the gym today. Okay, like, I guess I'll move on and do X, Y, and Z instead.
Yeah.
It's this, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? If I can't work out, then this is going to happen.
Right.
There's catastrophizing that goes on. There's overestimating probability that goes on. Oh my gosh, if I don't get to the gym, I'm going to lose all my progress. If I don't get to the gym now, I'm going to gain back all that weight. So yeah, there's clearly a difference. And so to be truly healthy, mentally, physically, emotionally, socially, and all those things, we want to expand our idea of what health is, and then always be asking ourselves, like, where are we at on that spectrum of rigid to flexibility? We it's okay to have preferences, but when we get into the realm of needs, like, I need to have healthy food, I need to stay away from sugar, someone else is calling the shots. You're not calling the shots.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I think also it does come from, and this is true, I mean, everybody hears all the time, like, hey, exercise is a great way to manage stress and anxiety. And it is, that's absolutely true. And so what I find sometimes is people will take that on, like, oh, I have to exercise. Well, I know you do, you should exercise. I'm not telling you not to. I need it to manage my anxiety. But sometimes for somebody who is already in the grips of an anxiety disorder of some kind that we talk about all the time, that thing that says, well, the exercise manages my anxiety. Okay, but you spent your hour on doing cardio in your bedroom on your treadmill, but you can't go further than a half a mile from your house otherwise. So is it actually managing your anxiety or not? Like, that's not, and look, I know that sometimes sounds really harsh, but that's not the progress that you are hoping for. I know that you want to be able to solve your agoraphobia problem, for instance. That workout is not, it's part of it, keep doing it, but you can't sit on that as, look, I did my workout, it made me feel good, but I can't go get my kids at school. My husband has to do that, or whoever. Yeah, I'm just, that and becomes a pervasive thing.
The word that you're bringing up that comes to my mind is the word compulsive. Like, anything can become compulsive.
Yeah, yeah.
I like to take a nice shower whenever I'm I have had a long day. Yeah, I like to get away from my toddler and like away from the sensory overload and just take a shower.
Yep.
That can certainly become compulsive, right? Like, if I'm managing my anxiety by constantly showering,
right,
that's a problem. Socializing is another great example that coincides a lot with the whole fitness thing. Like, it's socially acceptable for the most part. Like, people do it, whatever. Socializing constantly as a way to manage anxiety is, if it's done compulsively, that's also not good.
Yeah.
And so we want to have coping skills, but we don't want to use any one of those compulsively, whether it's taking a shower, like I've said, whether it's socializing with peers, whether it's, I mean, we have people here who like compulsively do crossword puzzles. Like, they just can't tolerate their anxiety. They need to be busy, busy, busy all the time.
Yeah.
And so then we'll like take away their crossword puzzles, because we don't want people to use anything compulsively, especially things that are not portable.
Right.
Like,
right.
like you can't always, it's great to socialize with people.
Yeah.
And you're not always going to have that around. It's great to rely on exercise to manage your anxiety from time to time.
Yeah.
And you may not always be able to do it. So right. We need people to come up with portable coping skills, which is what partly what we teach as far as our program goes. We teach them one, sitting with it, yeah. which is just allowing yourself to feel the anxiety, allowing yourself to feel the discomfort. You can do that alone, naked, and in the desert. Those are the coping skills that you should be using,
yeah.
things that you can use alone, naked, and in the desert.
Yep.
Listening to music is another good one. Great coping skill, but what if you're freaking out and you're super, super anxious in the middle of a grocery store and you don't have your iPod with you?
Right. Like, what happens?
Yeah. Like yeah. we need to be able to release our compulsive use of these coping skills so that we can always just sit with anxiety. We can tolerate that.
Yeah.
Another good one would be respiratory control. So respiratory control is a way to kind of engage your parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah.
It's a certain way of breathing and trying to help manage that.
And if you're alive, you have a convenient focus point. Your breath is always with you. It's portable. You can focus there if you need to.
Yeah. But even that, I wouldn't want people to do that compulsively it's all, and unfortunately, there's no like black and white as people with anxiety often want. They often want like, can I do this or can I not do this?
Yeah.
Well, it kind of depends. Like how often are you relying on that? Big picture, are you able to seek out other forms of coping? So as far as the exercise goes, that can definitely be compulsive. And you have to ask yourself again, like, how would I manage if in the event that I can't access that, like, could I manage?
Yeah. Yeah.
The answer is like, sure, that would suck, but I would figure it out. That's a good sign. If the response is, oh my gosh, no, I don't know what I would do. That would make me so anxious. It's maybe time to loosen up your grip.
And I think part of that too, is understanding that the exercise should be part of your toolkit. It cannot be the only thing in the toolkit because it's not going to solve the problem by itself. And that's a hard realization to face, but it's reality is better than delusion. So good, very good discussion. I love it. I want to tease a little because we talked about another topic and like we'll have Jenna on again. You have also, and we can't get into it now because we're running out of, we're going to do a little teasing here, like the evening news, something in your house is killing you. We'll tell you after the break. Yeah, so you have also dealt with a bunch of postpartum type stuff as a mom and mom-related issues. Mm-hmm. And I think the next time we have you on, which hopefully will be very soon, we can talk about those things too. How did you go through those issues, postpartum anxiety, depression, OCD, as a trained therapist?
Fascinating discussion. Yeah, really, really unique experience.
Yeah.
So when I had my son back in February of 2018, by then I had been working with this population for like 10 years. Yeah. This has been my life, and working in residential, I knew it frontwards, forwards, backwards. Like I knew it. I was very confident in the skills of how to manage anxiety, what to expect, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, all that stuff. I knew that, you know, as I would become a mom, that I would probably have intrusive thoughts because we all have intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
I knew that I would be more vulnerable to those things. And I thought that I was just a little bit immune to it, I think is a good word. And long story short, we'll save it for if we do another podcast, which hopefully we do. It hit me hard. It hit me so hard. And I've recovered. I've been to therapy, and being to therapy as a therapist was a really awesome experience.
Yeah.
But it was really challenging. As much as I felt like that my education and my experience would have made me protected or immune in some way, I feel like it almost worked against me, because in the times where I would be really, really high anxiety and really struggling, I almost felt this dual guilt on top of it, and this dual like imposter syndrome. Like, Jenna, you know what you should be doing. You know what you should be doing. Like, why is this still so hard for you? And so that almost worked against me. And it was just a really, I want to say interesting now that I'm kind of over that period of my life, but it was awful in the moment. And it really, obviously looking back, like it gave me such a better perspective as to what people with OCD and anxiety go through in the moment, because I've always been anxious, kind of like I mentioned in the beginning, but it never overtook me. Like I always won.
Right.
Um, And so I didn't know, I couldn't relate to what the other side was like. And now having been through that, I understood it so much better. So it ended up being a great eye-opening experience. And importantly, what got me motivated to working with the postpartum population was, I remember very vividly having this really horrible day and looking outside and thinking, like, if I'm struggling this much and I have all the context for what's going on with me, what are other moms doing? Like, we have to get them this information. We have to, like, I cannot imagine, as hard as it was having the context for it. And like I said, that almost worked against me. I would have been so, I would have driven myself crazy
without
if I was experiencing all those things and I had no context for it.
I get it. You know what we should do? Like, do you have, well, we need to get them the information. You're right. We're making this up as we go, by the way. None of this was planned out for the most part. Do you, how much more time do you have? Can you do another?
I have until like 1:15, 1:30.
Okay, so you have some time. So here's what we're going to do. Let's end this one. This is going to be episode 136. So what I'm going to tell everybody is come back next week and you'll hear Jenna, and I'm going to kill this one and then we'll just record the next one right now. If you have another 20 minutes or so, you ready to do it? Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So where can people find you? Which I'm going to ask you again in about 30 minutes. So it's going to be really awkward, but where can they find you?
So you can find me. I have a website, www.jennaoverbaugh.com. There I have an email newsletter that you can sign up for every week. I do every Sunday. I put out a weekly hard thing challenge. And so it's going to be different every week. Just something difficult, something hard that you guys can challenge yourself with to kind of keep working those muscles of tolerating the hard stuff. I think it's great. I also am on Instagram. That's probably the most likely place where you'll find me, at jenna.overbaugh. And then, like I mentioned, I do also have a podcast. So it's called All the Hard Things, and it's available on all podcast platforms. You can go there to find information on mom's mental health. You can go there to find information on OCD and anxiety. Pretty much, I walk you through all the hard things, and it's really, really fun, and tons of, you know, information, resources, all available on my website. So
excellent. Yeah, I will link on that. If you guys go to theanxioustruth.com/136, you'll get this episode, and I'll make sure that Jenna's links are all there. I'll link the podcast and everything, so you guys can get them there. Thank you a bunch. I'm going to say goodbye, but then don't go away because we're going to record the next one right away. Guys, thanks for listening, and come back next week to hear the postpartum stuff because we're going to talk about that now. All right, that was all kinds of fun to do. Definitely going to have Jenna back in the next episode to talk about the postpartum stuff that we mentioned at the end of this one. If you need to find Jenna online, you can find her at jennaoverbaugh.com or just go to theanxioustruth.com/136 for this episode. And I will make sure I link all over to all of Jenna's stuff, her website, her Instagram, and her podcast, so you can find her that way. I'm going to ask you guys, as usual, before we leave, if you are listening on iTunes or some other platform that allows you to rate and review the podcast, maybe take a moment and do that. Leave a rating or a review because it helps other people find the podcast. And if more people find it, more people get help, which is why I do this. And thanks for coming by. I'm going to play you out, as usual, with our friend Ben Drake doing Afterglow. You can find Ben at facebook.com/BenDrakeMusic. Thank you, Ben, for permission to use this most awesome piece of music. Thanks for coming by, guys, and I will see you next week. It's all around you, you can breathe it in. And this is where your story begins. You got the feeling that you're gonna win. Yeah, you're on your way. It's in the afterglow.